This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Ezzy Pearson, Features Editor of BBC Sky at Night magazine. On today's episode of Radio Astronomy, I'm talking to Dermot Geffings. 50 years ago, Dermot, along with students from 79 other countries, was invited by NASA to witness the launch of the Apollo 17 moon mission and get a look behind the scenes at all aspects of the space mission as it was going on, as part of what was known as the International Youth Science Tour.
So, Dermot, that sounds like an absolutely incredible opportunity. So can you tell me a bit more about exactly what the International Youth Science Tour was and how you came to be chosen?
Hi, Ezzy. This was a groundbreaking venture of NASA and the US State Department in 1972. Apollo 17 was the last mission to the moon in the Apollo program. And NASA and the US State Department and the United Nations wanted to do something very special to mark that final moon landing. And so, as you say, they decided to take one science student who was also very keen on spaceflight and astronomy from each United Nations country, as they were at the time, and bring them together, paid for by US industries and private sector, on this tour as VIP guests for a whirlwind three-week tour of NASA facilities. In the 1960s, as I always say to people, I was a child of the golden age of space flight, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and I was passionately keen on that, as many young lads were in the day. I was also a keen amateur astronomer from the age of about 10. And throughout my 5 years as then secondary school, up to 1972, I formed, along with some friends, the Astronomy Club, and I ran that for my 5 years there. And part of that I always used to really like giving talks and presentations, and I got asked to give presentations on Apollo and also astronomy as well to other local schools, primary schools, mainly. And so I did that. And through the local media, the local press, the United States Embassy in London heard about me, the Cultural Office, and they contacted me in October 1972 to say that NASA is planning this venture. Can you give us a call if you're interested? Of course, yes. And they explained that they would like me to go down to the US Embassy for an interview, which I did, and also submit some of the essays I'd written on the benefits of space flight, the benefits of the space program. So I went down October 72 and had a 2.5 hour long interview with three people. They explained that there were 16 other students from around the UK that were candidates for this. And I answered 20 or so questions on astronomy and space in general and the Apollo missions, and I got them all correct. So I came back home. Heard nothing for a couple of weeks, thinking I might get a letter, a second-class letter, saying we regret to say. But a couple of weeks later, I did get a second-class letter, but it said, congratulations, you've been chosen to represent the people of the United Kingdom for the Apollo 17 moon mission. So this was a dream come true.
I can imagine. So you were one of 80 students who were chosen. What were the other representatives like?
Okay, they were from all parts of the world. The other students, they were aged between 16 and 18, were from all kinds of backgrounds. Some were from very wealthy backgrounds. Some were from pretty ordinary working class backgrounds like myself. Some were what NASA referred to at the time on our tour as children of the soil, from very, very poor backgrounds, the African continent and so forth. And NASA and the State Department ensured that there were few, if not no language barriers, because they had excellent interpreters. The three main languages spoken were English, French, and Spanish. And the interpreters ensure that we could all communicate well together and get to know one another, which we did very quickly and get on. I think I guess it's a bit like our international scientific consortiums of today. I can draw parallels to that, where no matter what the politics or religious views are of anywhere in the world, people transcend that and work together for a common purpose.
And I know you began your trip to the US a couple of days before the launch, but I think certainly for me, the part that I'm most jealous of, I must say, was the fact that you got to watch the actual launch of Apollo 17. So at just past midnight on the morning of the 7th, can you take us back to that day in 1972 and tell us a bit about what that was like?
I can take you back. Well, first of all, very early morning on the day of launch, because it should have been the 6th of December, and it was going to be the first ever time that they'd launched men into space at nighttime. So a spectacular nighttime launch was on the cards. But I, along with the other students and NASA officials, stayed at a hotel in near Orlando in Florida. We had to be up very early in the morning because we were being taken over to Kennedy Space Center after breakfast. I recall stepping out of my hotel room, which was stepped onto a balcony to admire the palm trees and the swimming pool and so forth. I've never been to the States before, never been to Florida. And as I stepped out of my room, I absolutely bumped into this very tall, large gentleman with his family, and accidentally stood on the edge of his foot. And I looked up to apologise to him, and he looked down at me and smiled. And I recognised him straight away. It was my hero. It was Neil Armstrong.
My goodness. And you just ran into him outside of your hotel room?
Yeah, and he was there to actually join us for the launch, not travel with us directly, but be present with us at the launch. And we had a formal meeting with him the following day. But certainly this was day of launch, and we walked down together to his car, and his wife grabbed my camera and took a photograph of Neil and I shaking hands together. And we had a conversation for a few moments, a few minutes, and it was a wonderful experience to meet a lifelong hero.
I can imagine.
But getting to the launch, we had a behind-the-scenes, very, very privileged view of Kennedy Space Center. I know there are tours these days that take you to many places, but we were allowed to be taken into the vehicle assembly building. And in there, the Saturn V rocket was fully assembled in the high bay for the Skylab space station mission, which was being launched the following month. And so we had we were able to stand at the base of this thing and look up the 365 feet to the top of this fantastic Saturn V live moon rocket. But we were taken out to some of the launch pads from the Mercury and Gemini era. And by evening, of course, December, darkness fell very, very early. We had dinner. And then we were taken out to the one of the VIP stands adjacent to the vehicle assembly building, which was to our right. And the launch should have taken place at 9:53 p.m. And the showers began to come down on us. There was lightning in the distance. We were fearful the launch might be scrubbed. But then they were going ahead. Things were running very smoothly, and they turned out all of the spotlights at Kennedy Space Center. So it was in pitch darkness, and they turned out the searchlights that were bathing the rocket. So it really was quite dark, and. When the countdown got to 30 seconds, a critical point where the computers on board decide whether to go or no go, the countdown stopped. There was a hold. That hold lasted for a couple of hours because sensors had told them that one of the third stage tanks hadn't pressurized correctly. And they managed to override that remotely. But finally, at 12:33 on the morning of 7th, the final countdown got underway, and the launch was, I've got to use the word awesome, although it's a very, very overly used word these days. Everything seems to be awesome. But in the true sense of the word, it was, because I had an 8mm cine camera, a movie camera with me, so I could film this. And when the countdown reached about 9 seconds, these huge orange flames erupted from the base of the rocket, which was 3 miles away. That's the nearest you're allowed to be to the Saturn V, because it had the explosive force of a small atomic bomb. And the flames and steam shot out from the flame trenches miles to either side. And then slowly, inexorably, the Saturn V began to clear past the tower. And it was silence up to that time because the sound waves hadn't travelled the 3 miles. And then they hit us. And boy, did they hit us. It wasn't just the sound waves, it was the pressure pulse from the engines. They hit you hard in the chest, and the ground begins to shake. The stands around us, we were all stood up, of course, at this time, and everything was rattling and shaking violently. And I can remember, you never forget anything like that. It's not just a visual thing, you actually experience it and feel it. The sound of the engines was a very staccato-like, snapping, crackling sound that each pressure pulse from the engines made these snaps and crackles crackle against and tingle against the skin on your face. So it was really, you know, something that your body experienced and rattled you to your core. I can remember the noise was almost distressing. It was that loud. And it lasted mm-hmm. for a couple of minutes as the vehicle pitched over and pointed downrange over the Atlantic Ocean. And when things quietened down, the NASA piped the voices of the astronauts' exchanges with Mission Control Houston, who had now taken over the mission once the vehicle had cleared the tower. And you could hear the exchanges. You could hear Cern and Schmidt and Evans on board the Apollo 17, which appeared like a star then, arcing out over the Atlantic Ocean. And the exchanges between Mission Control Houston and we saw the staging, the separation of the first stage and the ignition of the second stage, and a huge bright flash in the sky. But I can remember the voice of launch control going back just a few minutes. As the Saturn cleared the tower, he said, "It's like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center." It was literally like being stood in the middle of the desert on a bright summer's day. It was that luminous, incredibly bright. So that was the launch. And I think we got back to the hotel around 4 o'clock in the morning, and we had to be up a couple of hours later to go on to our next place on the tour.
That sounds like an absolutely incredible experience as well. The fact that it was a night launch and you got that sort of to really appreciate how bright it was. But because, of course, as you said, this was the only Apollo mission that had a hold on it at 30 seconds. And because now today, or every time that you see all launches are live streamed with commentary over the top.
Yeah.
Did you know what was happening when that hold was going on, or were you all just sitting there waiting for it to go?
No, the public affairs officer at Kennedy Space Center was continually commentating on developments. And so we were kept up to speed of what was happening. I mean, there were silences in between while the ground crews figured things out. There were more than 400 technicians in the firing room, which was adjacent to the vehicle assembly building. Of course, these days, there's probably something like a dozen or two people in launch control, I guess. But in those days, it was over 400 in analog technology days. And it was such an enormous relief when they resumed the count after midnight, because we were going to go, and this was an historic event, which would have been tragic to miss if they had to scrub till another day and we couldn't be around.
And It was particularly historic, this one, because it was the last Apollo mission, and you all knew that whilst you were there. Did that make being at the launch particularly poignant in any way?
It did, Ezzy. It made it. We knew, although we were kind of 16 and 17 years of age, we knew exactly that this was a special point in history, a special moment in history, and that Apollo was paving the way for future greatness in space. We knew that that Skylab was being launched, America's first space station was being launched the following month, and that the space shuttle was in its early stages of development. And we did get a chance to see a mock-up of that later on in the tour. But yes, we were aware of the historic significance of that, and of course the Goodwill Moon Rock as well, which appeared later in the tour.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the Goodwill Moon Rock, one of the other big highlights of your tour was on the 13th of December, which was the day that Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt were on the surface conducting their third and final extravehicular activity, EVA. And they actually, I believe, spoke to you directly from the surface. Can you tell me more about what that day was like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we'd spent 3 days at Mission Control in Houston, and we had a fantastic background behind the scenes view of astronaut training and so forth. And we were on that particular day in question. We were situated at the back of the Mission Control room. We had to all be very, very quiet, because it isn't a noisy place in Mission Control. We had to be very quiet, and we could see on the big screen at the front of Mission Control the astronauts walking on the surface of the moon close to the lunar module. Directly in front of me, and I was in the back left-hand corner of Mission Control, was Ed Fendell. Ed Fendell was one of the mission controllers who actually controlled the camera, the live television camera, which was mounted on the front of the lunar rover vehicle, for which they traversed some frightening distances around the lunar surface. You could see him move his controls on his console, and then a second or so later, allowing for the speed of light delay, the camera then moved on the lunar surface. But Cernan and Schmidt, they mentioned that a group of students from all over the world was gathered in Mission Control that night, and it was quite late at night at that time. And they picked up a piece of rock, an ordinary piece of rock, and Commander Cernan spoke to our group directly and said, Jack has picked up a piece of rock, a fairly ordinary rock, but composed of many fragments that's been on the lunar surface for billions of years, and it has coalesced and lived in harmony with its own components for eons, and that this rock would be given to each member of the group, of the tour, and that they would present it to their nations, to the peoples of their country, with a message of goodwill from Apollo 17 and peace and hopes for the future. And Jack Schmidt then added a few words that echoing Commander Cernan's words. And we were to be custodians of what's to be called the Goodwill Moon Rock, or Friendship Rock. There were two of these. The Apollo 11 crew brought back a Friendship Rock. This was the Apollo 17 Goodwill Moon Rock, and I was to be custodian of that.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's a lovely thing, I think, that they did on that one, sort of spreading, showing that this mission was for the entire world and not just for the US.
Absolutely.
That's lovely. And you did, those I think are probably the biggest highlights from the mission, from your time in the US. But you did a whole range of things on your trip. Were there anything else that particularly stood out in your mind?
Oh, yeah. This whirlwind tour lasting some 3 weeks, we were flying to different NASA facilities or other scientific facilities on average every other day. We went to the Atomic Energy Facility at Oak Ridge in Tennessee, which was very, very interesting. But then we getting back to kind of Apollo, we spent a day at the George C. Marshall Space Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And some of the American, German rocket scientists, some of them of whom had been part of Wernher von Braun's team, who, as you know, developed much of American rocketry, they were there to give us a guided tour of all the test stands and so forth. And we also had a really good look at the neutral buoyancy tank, which was then the biggest training tank in the world. And we looked through the portholes there of the tank, and we saw inside a full-size mock-up of the Skylab space station, and some of the astronauts actually suited up with divers practicing an EVA on the Apollo telescope mount, which was, of course, used for solar observations. It made quite a valuable contribution to solar observations in the early 70s. But another highlight was to go to the famous JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and have a chance to sit in the mission control where they were monitoring the Pioneer probes, which are on the way to the outer edge of the solar system. So we had some fantastic experiences there. I think another little highlight, which was rather cheeky, but we did a tour of North American Rockwellers plant in Downey, California. They were the people that built the Apollo command modules, amongst other things. And they had their CASPER, the Apollo 16 command module, which had been to the moon a few months earlier, and it was on its test stand in the factory for post-flight analysis. And of course, we were VIP guests, and we split up into small groups to tour this huge facility. And I asked the official very cheekily if he would allow me to just climb inside the center seat of the command module, which staggeringly he allowed me to do so as long as I didn't touch anything. So I was able to climb up little steps and climb through the hatch into the center seat, which is more like a hammock, really, on a collapsible frame, to where astronaut Ken Mattingly would have sat during the flight of Apollo 16 with Charlie Duke and John Young, and take a tiny piece of the heat shield as well, which I still have. but I mean, you would never be allowed to do that, understandably, quite rightly so, these days. because these artifacts are quite rightly so valuable museum pieces. I know the Smithsonian in Washington in particular do a lot of restoration and take great care of these items.
You already mentioned there that you met Neil Armstrong.
Yeah.
Were there any other notable figures that you met during your time?
Yeah. Whilst in Mission Control, Admiral Alan Shepard met us, and he took us to the auditorium and gave us a presentation on the future of NASA.
Alan Shepard, of course, being the first US astronaut.
Yes, indeed, he was, as he, and also commander of Apollo 14. He led the mission to the highlands of Fra Mauro, where Apollo 13 should have landed had it not been for the near-fatal explosion on board. And Alan Shepard, he was wonderful, and he led us down to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, now known as the Planetary Materials Laboratory. But there they had these special containers with the yet-unstudied moon rocks from the previous Apollo missions, which we were allowed to look at very, very close up. And so that was an incredible experience. But there were other scientific figures, such as Harold P. Klein, who had worked with people like Carl Sagan on the Viking missions, in particular life detection experiments aboard Viking. And over at the University of Berkeley in California, we had a tour of the Bevatron particle accelerator there. And our host for the day was Dr. Luis Alvarez, who is a Nobel Prize laureate. And he worked on the bubble chamber and discovery of the positron, I believe. But he had also worked with Oppenheimer on the, got conscripted for that, with Oppenheimer on the Manhattan Project as well. So he was a very distinguished scientist to meet. I think the final sort of person on the tour that of at the time maybe didn't have, well, quite have the fame, but later he would, was the tour finally ended on the 19th of December at the United Nations mission in New York. And following a tour of the UN, we had a lunch with the United States ambassador to the United Nations, and his name was George H.W. Bush, later to become president of the United States. We had lunch with him and three of us, one from Spanish, French and English-speaking nations, gave a thank you speech to NASA, the State Department, and the people of the United States for their kindness and courtesy and privilege, fantastic privileges given to us by NASA in particular during that tour. And it was closed by Mr. Bush.
And did you, because there were a lot of people there from around the world reporting, was there anybody from the UK that you met whilst you were out there on your trip?
I a couple of people in Houston. James Burke, who was the BBC correspondent. James Burke used to present Tomorrow's World back in the 1960s. And he, along with Sir Patrick Moore, covered for the BBC just about all of the Apollo missions, long hours of broadcasting day and night. Sir Patrick, I think, was having a rest period. It was nighttime and he was having a break. But I did spend quite a bit of time with James Burke and kind of became pen pals with him for a while. And also another sort of great BBC correspondent from the day, Reginald Turnhill. He was there with his wife, and he had just written a book on space flight, an observer's book. I spent time with him.
And whilst you were looking behind the scenes, did you actually manage to get to see any of the the lunar material that had been brought back from the previous Apollo missions?
Yes, at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, as it was known then, these days it's called the Planetary Materials Laboratory. But we were led down there, and they had a room, and they'd set it out, and the, as the Americans call it, these alloy caskets that had were kept in a vacuum or in a inert gas. They were samples of rocks and soil from all of the previous missions. One particular one that they had separated was the famous Genesis rock from Apollo 15, which is a very white coloured, almost like pumice stone. We had to had a really good close up view of that. They had these special chambers set up with in a vacuum with a glove that you could put your hand in and touch a piece of moon rock, which I think they had, as we were VIP guests, just had that one set up to one side just to enable us to do that. Not everyone did. All 80 students didn't go places all together. The groups were split into very small groups and to make it more manageable, so while other students did different things. So that was very memorable, to see these iconic samples so close up. And as I understand it, probably well in the 90s percentage of all the lunar materials have not yet been studied, as NASA had that foresight not to do destructive testing on them until the technologies improved over the decades. So that was quite an interesting foresight by them. So globally, only a very, very tiny percentage of these rocks are under study.
Yeah, and in fact, there was, I believe, earlier this year, there was a sample that they put into cold storage for 50 years, specifically to thaw out this year, to take advantage of modern techniques, which I thought was very smart of them. There's been quite a lot of advancement in the last 50 years. But as you said, they are obviously quite careful with these pieces of rock. So I'm kind of curious how you managed to get yours, because obviously the crew came back just as you were finishing your trip, and presumably they didn't just, you know, hand you a piece of rock out of the module. So how did you eventually get your piece of Goodwill rock?
Okay. The Goodwill moon rock sample has a designated catalogue number with NASA, which is 70017. Mm-hmm. And that was fragmented, not the entirety of that rock, but a portion of that rock was separated and fragmented down after the mission into 80 small pieces. And it was actually seven months later that that I got hold of it, and I had to travel down to the US Embassy, Grosvenor Square, as it was then, in London, in 12th of July, 1973, and went to the Air Force Attaché's office, and there was the Air Force Attaché, along with Brigadier General Jim McDivitt, who was former astronaut, commander of Gemini 4 with Ed White, the late Ed White, and he was commander of Apollo 9. And he was there to travel with me to Downing Street, and another chap from the cultural office there, Mr. Michael Pistor, he brought in the Goodwill moon rock, which was embedded in a glass ball on a hardwood plaque, and along with a small Union Jack, which had been taken to the lunar surface by Schmidt and Evans. Indeed, all of the Goodwill moon rock rocks that were presented throughout the world had a small flag of their nation taken to the lunar surface. And the plaque had a message of goodwill and peace from the then President of the United States, Richard Nixon. So I was briefed on the protocols of being custodian for this rock. And that day we travelled to in a couple of cars to 10 Downing Street, where we presented it to the then Prime Minister, Mr. Edward Heath, along with Mr. Walter Annenberg, who was the United States ambassador to the United Kingdom then. So we presented that to Edward Heath. I gave a short speech to Mr. Heath, thanking NASA, thanking to the people of the United States for the privileges of handing over this piece of rock for the people of the United Kingdom. And so that was a very special day, and it subsequently went to the Natural History Museum, where it is still on display some 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully some of our listeners will be hearing this story and be inspired to go down and visit it, because I've seen it myself down in the Natural History Museum before I met you and talked to you and knew the story behind it. So that's absolutely brilliant to hear. And so this is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 17 this year. How will you be spending those first few weeks in December commemorating the day?
Well, I have a number of presentations to give on this very subject. For the past couple of years, friends in my own astronomy society that I'm involved with, Preston and District Astronomical Society, and also the University of Central Lancashire, Jeremiah Horrocks Institute, amongst others, said, you know, you need to write a booklet on this. You need to give presentations because this is an important piece of history that you were involved in. And so I have some presentations to give in December at one or two other astronomical societies. I'm also involved in with Liverpool Astronomical Society on the 10th of December. They are doing a special Apollo 17 50th anniversary event, a huge event in Liverpool Library. A couple of evenings prior to that, on the 7th of December, which is the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 17, I'm giving a couple of the late talks at the National Space Centre in Leicester, which I'm really looking forward to.
So certainly it sounds like there's a lot going on.
There is.
Thank you very much, Dermot, for taking the time out of your day to talk to us. That was an absolutely fascinating story. And I'm very glad that you got to be able to experience that and to share it with us. So thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for a great magazine as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.